Netflix and Disney. Is this the most magical match on earth? From APM, it's the Marketplace Midday Update podcast, and I am Jeff Horwich. It is Wednesday, December 5th. We'll also talk about Citigroup shrinking to suit the times, working out the skills mismatch between future workers and the companies that need them, the plan to use hedge funds to pay more to Nobel Prize winners, and the U.S. government tries to make you feel better about both the zombie apocalypse and that other one that happens in 16 days, right?
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Netflix has zippity-doo-dah a new deal with Disney. The video streaming company will get first dibs once movies leave theaters. That means not just Disney princesses and stuff, but Pixar, Marvel, as well as any new Muppets or Star Wars films. Kind of amazing how many great brands Disney has swallowed up over the years. Before you get too excited, though, a lot of this won't take effect right away. And our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, is here with some zippity details. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Jeff.
So for consumers, for Netflix fans, how's this thing going to play out?
Well, I might start off by saying Netflix stock got a 14% pop on this news yesterday, but those shares have been mostly flat this morning, maybe because investors are realizing the main points of this new deal don't actually kick in for another 4 years, till 2016. That's because the Starz cable channel has Disney's first-run movies wrapped up till then. But a lot of the Disney classics, Dumbo and Pocahontas among them, are supposed to be available to Netflix viewers in the next few months.
So why does Netflix want, why do they need a deal like this so badly?
Well, this puts Netflix on the same playing field as the big movie channels on cable. I talked this morning to analyst Steve Frankel, who follows Netflix at Doherty Markets. He says Netflix clearly has its sights on HBO, and this first-run movie deal is just one sign of that.
They're also producing their own original content, which is right out of the HBO playbook. And when the Sony content comes up for bid at some point, I would expect Netflix to be in their bidding as well. I mean, they're going to try to go toe-to-toe with HBO.
By the way, HBO has around 30 million subscribers. Netflix has about 32 million. So this is shaping up to be a battle royale.
And Bob, if you're Disney, why choose Netflix?
Well, the terms haven't been made public, but the number floating around among analysts is $300 million a year that Netflix could be paying Disney for this. Steve Frankel mentioned the original series the cable channels have been giving more attention to. So this shows Netflix is a new source of revenue for Hollywood.
All right. Marketplace's Bob Moon. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And let's do the numbers. An interesting mixed result on Wall Street this morning. You don't see this very often, where the major indexes are not just sort of dinking around being flat, but some are up a lot, some are down a lot. At the moment, the Dow is up almost 0.9%, sitting at 13,065. The S&P 500, good measure of the broader market, is up about 0.4%. The NASDAQ is down 0.3%. Here's part of what might be going on, at least with the NASDAQ. After the bell yesterday, music streamer Pandora delivered a more gloomy outlook for advertising revenues in particular. Pandora blames the fiscal cliff. Some analysts say it's increasing competition that they're facing. Right now, Pandora shares are down, yep, there you go, 16%. Ouch. U.S. productivity growth has been revised upward for the latest quarter. That's good news for overall economic growth. Not such great news for people looking for jobs. The more we squeeze out of existing workers, that's productivity after all, the less pressure on employers to hire new ones. Well, we keep hearing, though, that there are plenty of jobs out there going unfilled for skilled and semi-skilled workers. A new report from the consulting group McKinsey highlights one key reason for this skills gap. McKinsey says it's the mismatch between the way educators, employers, and wannabe employees are trying to get ready for the workplace of the future. From our bureau in Portland, Oregon, here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
In this position, the operator's not just running the machine, he's responsible.
The factory floor at Benchmade Knives in Oregon City. Executives say they look long and hard to fill the most skilled positions. Mark McCallum was recently hired to maintain the precision cutting tools.
I kind of was one of those kids that decided to tear the TV apart, the toaster apart, dad's motorcycle apart.
McCallum got machinist training right out of high school, then a bachelor's degree.
From mechanical engineering, in my opinion, to do the job I do, you also have to educate yourself.
Problem is, according to today's McKinsey report, way too few young people know what to educate themselves in to start on a viable career path. McKinsey's Mona Morshid says more than half of U.S. employers can't find enough skilled workers like McCallum. And yet,
in the U.S., we find that only 45% of youth believe that post-secondary education actually improved their chances of employment.
Bonnie Spade sees this disconnect every day. She runs training programs at Reading Area Community College in Pennsylvania.
I don't know that we've done a great job with our kids to really help them to understand that you can go to school and get any degree you want, but which one of those is really going to get you that job?
Spade's community college programs are tailored to fill employers' needs. That's on the public's dime, but some critics say employers themselves should fund more on-the-job training. Then there might not be such a big skills gap in the first place. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
As I speak to you at this moment, Citigroup shares are up almost 6%. For better or worse, that's the kind of thing that often happens when a big company announces they are getting their costs in order through layoffs. Citigroup employs more Americans than any other bank, but this morning Citi announced 11,000 job cuts worldwide in the next year or two, some of them at least likely here in the U.S. Karen Petru is a banking analyst at Federal Financial Analytics. Good to talk with you.
Great to talk to you, Jeff.
11,000 job cuts sounds like an awful lot. Then again, Citigroup is huge, so put this in context for us.
It's a lot to the 11,000 people, but it's about 4% of their workforce. So in the scope of the company, it's not as dramatic as it might sound.
What kinds of costs are they trying to get a handle on here?
They're trying to get a handle on unproductive costs, areas where businesses could be made more efficient, and in some cases, businesses where the rules are changing and their structure doesn't work as well as it used to.
Do you know for Citigroup specifically what kinds of things that might apply to?
An example would be the changes in their institutional client operations. That's an area which is very affected by some of the new proposals, the so-called Volcker Rule, which is changing the way banks can work on their own behalf in conjunction with clients. But I think the bulk of these cuts are intended to improve efficiency, not to restructure the company.
Even some 4 years or whatever now after the financial crisis, are we continuing to see pressure not just at Citi, but across the banking industry to try to find those inefficiencies and cut costs wherever they can?
Oh, absolutely. The industry across the board is under considerable profit pressure, particularly in the U.S., where the Federal Reserve is demanding very stringent standards before big banks can pay dividends. Every big bank is looking under every cover to find areas where it can improve efficiency and therefore profitability.
Karen Petru, banking analyst at Federal Financial Analytics. Always good to talk with you. Thanks.
Thank you, Jeff.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
President Obama is going to be speaking to business leaders at some point today to try to rally support for his plan to avoid the fiscal cliff. Many U.S. businesses say they'd have to lay off workers if we go over it. But our cliff also has implications for the rest of the world. Earlier today, the BBC's economics correspondent Andrew Walker talked with my Morning Report colleague Jeremy Hobson. Here's Jeremy.
Well, so what is the expectation on your side of the pond, that the U.S. is going to go over the fiscal cliff or that there's going to be a deal to avoid that?
Well, an awful lot of people, I think, have been assuming that at the last minute, at least, there will be some sort of deal. But as the last minute gets closer to the present day and as the negotiations continue, I think doubts are growing about whether the U.S. will manage to avoid it.
And if there is no deal and we do go over the cliff, what kind of an impact would that have on the European debt crisis?
A lot depends on just how long the US goes over the cliff for. To use a rather strange metaphor, if they can jump back onto dry land fairly shortly afterwards, then the damage might be relatively limited. But bear in mind, for many European countries, the US is a very important export market. So if we were to see a significant downturn in the US, then of course that's going to affect the sales, particularly of countries like Germany that are really big exporters.
So are any preparations being made just in case we go over the cliff?
Well, I don't see that there are preparations specifically for the eventuality of the fiscal cliff. What you would need to do to minimise the damage is to just ensure that the European economy is in general terms as resilient as possible. And of course, there is a big effort going on to try and do that in the context of responding to the European debt crisis. It's just that they're making very slow progress in it.
So are leaders across Europe reaching out to their counterparts in Washington to try and make their concerns known?
They're not making a big public song and dance about it, but I'm sure behind the scenes they are doing so. And it's certainly the case that at the G20 summit in the summer, European leaders, along with everybody else, was telling President Obama very vigorously, you need to sort this out. Just as, I have to say, everybody else was telling European leaders that they need to sort out the problems on this side of the pond.
Yeah, it goes both ways, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Andrew Walker, economics correspondent for the BBC. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
This year's Nobel Prize winners received only $1.1 million. Yeah, I mean, come on, right? For 2012, the Nobel Foundation did have to cut the prize's cash award by about 20%. But as Sarah Gardner reports, the Swedes who run the Nobels have a plan to fix that.
The Nobel Foundation said it was forced to cut its prize amount to $1.2 million because, like a lot of us, it's been getting lousy investment returns. The solution, it's decided, is to cut expenses and invest more money in hedge funds. Seriously, Vanderbilt finance professor Nicholas Boland says proceed with caution.
The experience that university endowments went through post-financial crisis is that hedge funds are not a panacea.
Simon Lack, author of The Hedge Fund Mirage, says there are good hedge funds out there.
It's not that the whole industry is bad. The problem is that the average dollar invested does poorly.
In fact, as of September, only 8% of hedge funds were outperforming the S&P 500. And what would Alfred Nobel have to say when the Swedish industrialist slash dynamite inventor signed his will in 1895? He specified that most of his fortune be invested in safe securities. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Winding down here, a new report from Republican Senator Tom Coburn takes aim at what he calls wasteful spending by the Department of Homeland Security. Among his choice finds is a combat drill in October in which Marines and Navy Special Forces responded to a simulated, get this, zombie invasion. And this really happened. Evidently, the drill, which involved rescuing an official and his team trapped in a village, was based on lots of real-life scenarios, but officials just thought it would be kind of fun, since Halloween was coming up, to dress the bad guys as zombies. How much fun are they having now they're called out in Coburn's report? I don't know. Okay, from the zombie apocalypse to the real deal. If you need any more reassurance that life as we know it will not end in 16 days, as the ancient Mayan calendar maybe sort of seems to suggest, for some reason the U.S. government this week felt compelled to weigh in on the matter. The official statement comes from the blog of the federal government's main information portal, USA.gov, and the post states that whether it's the Mayan calendar, a comet, or a collision with a wayward planet, quote, the world will not end on December 21st, 2012, or any day in 2012. That's a pretty bold statement. Then again, it's pretty hard to hold them accountable if they are wrong. Just a quick note about the podcast the next 2 days, because we do hear from you guys if anything seems amiss, and we do always appreciate that. Of course, a guest host is going to be filling in for me tomorrow and Friday on air. What this means for the podcast is, as yet, just a little bit unclear. So if it rolls in a little later than you're used to tomorrow, or if we take a couple days off, don't be alarmed. What I can say for sure is it will be back to normal on Monday. And this is the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.